What if every student had a tutor and personalized learning was available to everyone? What if every family had a financial guide and their investments made for an optimistic future? What if every doctor could diagnose you in seconds and healthcare visits felt more personal? What if your business never slept and every customer's shopping experience felt like it was designed especially for them? It can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
What does possibility mean to you?
That's a hard question.
Something that you can strive for.
That I'm able to do anything I set my mind to.
You're confident in yourself and you believe in yourself. Stuff that you could achieve.
I feel excited. Anything is possible when you're more confident.
Shoes are a huge part of that. They are the most important part of my style.
You can like express yourself
in the right shoes.
Anything is possible.
DSW, countless shoes at bragworthy prices. Imagine the possibilities.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Barry Morphew was once the picture of a Colorado small town, respectively. Devoted father, churchgoer, family man, but when his wife Suzanne vanished on Mother's Day in 2020, that image began to crack a little bit. And when her remains were found 3 years later with a rare animal tranquilizer in her bones known as BAM, everything changed. Now, with the 2025 re-indictment on the table, prosecutors say they finally have what they need to prove Barry killed his wife. But in the case, is the case airtight or just cleverly assembled circumstantial evidence to paint a nice big pretty picture? Joining me is former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis to unpack the legal minefield surrounding the evidence, the failed first case, and whether this time justice might actually stick. So we know what the charges are. The allegation is Barry killed Suzanne. A bike was placed out somewhere. Her helmet was placed out, and eventually they found her body down a ravine. Once the snow melted, they were able to go find her. Prior to that, Barry was charged, and it came pretty close to getting to trial. And then last minute, it all got thrown out. Let's walk back there. Give us an analysis of why that happened in the first round in Colorado.
Sure. So, and then I practice in Colorado, yeah. So I'm very familiar with this case. In the first round, this was a rather small prosecutor's office, not always used to, you know, monster, nationally publicized murder cases. And they made some errors, and they made some serious errors. They didn't turn over some evidence to the defense that they should have turned over. There were other problems with the case, which caused a judge to determine that the prosecution's experts had to be excluded, that they couldn't even use them for the jury. And as we were approaching trial, they had not found the body yet. And so without these experts and without the body, I think the prosecutors folded at that point and dismissed the case. Subsequently, the body was found. Subsequently, there was this analysis that shows this tranquilizer in the victim that they think they can connect to Barry Morphew. So here we are during the second indictment for murder of Barry Morphew concerning his wife.
And there were some very serious things that went on in the first trial. I mean, I believe it was the DA or the prosecutor was disbarred.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
tell me about that. I mean, explain that. And I mean, and is that something that could be brought into this trial of like, look what happened the first round?
the prosecutorial misconduct and errors on the government side, including holding on to important evidence and evidence that can be exculpatory, that could show innocence. Prosecution can't do that. That's a cardinal rule. On top of that, there were a series of other errors that caused this, the elected prosecutor and the jurisdiction to be disbarred. Very uncommon. Now, I think the judge is going to really run a tight ship this second round and probably prohibit the jury from hearing about that disbarment. However, could some of those prosecutorial missteps come into evidence? Could the jury hear about those? Potentially.
And that's, it's not a look you want if you're on the prosecution of any. I mean, granted, I know it's all new prosecutors. It's being tried in a whole different county now. So it's not the same group by any means. But it is something when you're wanting a jury to try and find some sort of reasonable doubt. I mean, if the first one got dropped, why is this one still? I mean, we know why, but it's little things, little nuggets you can throw in there. And hopefully they stick if you're the defense of Barry Morphew. Her remains contained BAM, the rare tranquilizer only Barry is known to have used. It's a big deal. It's a big forensic link. But it is circumstantial. Barry used BAM while deer farming years ago when they were in Indiana, and it really hadn't been, I guess, allegedly using it since. The purchase of it was several years earlier. And they didn't find any on the property when they looked the first time. So we did find a dart cap, a broken dart gun that apparently wasn't working, you know, but I guess all things you would dispose of after you killed someone or make your gun look like it's not operable. What do you think about that? The fact that there wasn't the chemical in the house to go and say, look, this is you. It's just we got receipts for you buying it a long time ago in a different state.
You know, I think the government is going to be fine neutralizing that issue because that they have a lot of other evidence. What they say is Barry covering this up, doing concealing measures to make sure he doesn't get caught. He's going around to all these different dumpsters and dumping stuff. And you know, there's no real reason why he would need to go to four different dumpsters to do that. And so I think the government's going to say, hey, even though it wasn't on his property at the time, that's because he covered this up because he knew we were coming for him.
Yeah, I mean, there's all of that. A lot of consciousness there that looks of guilt and the seven dumpsters going and dumping stuff. And yeah, on the surface, I can't think of any reason one would be going to seven different dumpsters to be dumping different things, unless they're all full, which is a stupid excuse. But he's saying, I go out here, I'm a contractor, I got a lot of junk in my truck, I don't like to go pay the dump fee, so I just kind of dump it around at different places. I don't know. I mean, I think people may look at that and go, well, I'm not a contractor, so maybe they do move it around a different, I don't, it seems unlikely. It seems like a contractor wouldn't be going to seven different dumpsters, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, quite honestly.
I think there's some plausibility to that defense, and I don't know personally.
Yeah.
But there are complicating observations as well. So some of Barry Morphew's workers claim that that day, when the government thinks he was sort of covering all of this up, there was the strong smell of bleach around him that wouldn't have been necessary at the particular job site. There were just some other curious circumstances for Barry Morphew in terms of how he was moving around the state and that kind of thing that I think make things more suspicious. But then again, maybe it was just a contractor, you know, trying his best to dump out stuff where he could dump it out. Could be.
Could it be just a case of the worst coincidences ever? I don't know about that. Barry's phone also went into airplane mode minutes after Suzanne's last text to her lover. Again, not the best of timing here. A blackout like that, I mean, does that suggest consciousness of guilt in a legal context? And also, with his phone, his vehicle GPS also went dark. I don't even know how you do that, but apparently there's something you can unplug somewhere where your vehicle's going to stop tracking you, and then it turns back on suspiciously several hours later, 8 hours later. Oh, weird.
You know, weird. Yeah, I think people are sort of getting wise to the fact that our phones all have GPS, and if a person didn't want to be tracked, they would have to somehow deactivate that, and it looks like that could be what happened. Alternatively, you know, he might say, hey, my phone went dead at that time, and there was nothing I could do about it, and so it wasn't covering something up. And so all of these peculiar circumstances are going to be up to the juror's interpretation, and they're going to look at it as a whole when combined with all of, you know, the bleach smell and the multiple dumpsters and this BAM. You know, is that going to be enough to get the prosecution over the hump? That's the question.
How many experienced chipmunk hunters do you think are going to be on the jury? Serious question.
You know,
how many?
In that part of Colorado, more than you'd expect, maybe.
Yeah,
but still, you know, there are a lot of interesting wrinkles to this sort of rurally set case that are going to be specific to that locale. And so these jurors are going to know more about squirrel hunting than certainly I am.
Y'all got a chipmunk epidemic in Colorado. And I've been there. I mean, there's like one mountain town where I've gone to, and it was an old mining town. It's like haunted or something, and there's not much up there. But it's like, the chipmunks, there's hundreds of them, and they hang out on like wood and pallets. You can walk over, they'll climb on you. It's the craziest. I have like video of the kids when they were younger at this. Like, you got chipmunks, you got prairie dogs, you got the rodents going on. And they're surprisingly like fairy rodents. They're very friendly. I do like the rodents in Colorado. I don't know if the chipmunks. I don't know if a chipmunk's a rodent, but they seem friendly. But
there are places where the chipmunks are really the ones in charge. I think they have seats on city council by now.
Yeah.
There are some issues once you get closer to the mountains with those little critters.
It makes you wonder. So I could see that. I could see, I know the chipmunk analogy sounds ridiculous to a lot of people. I have to admit, in Wisconsin, I have hunted a few chipmunks in my time. I'm not proud of it. I was a smaller child, and my dad said, here's the BB gun, go take care of the chipmunks. And you know, when you're taking out chipmunks, you do run around your yard a lot. I will attest that that is a real thing if you are hunting a chipmunk with a BB gun. I think maybe a poison dart might be a bridge too far for a chipmunk. But, he told investigators that his erratic phone movements were from chasing chipmunks. How do you think that'll land out there in Colorado?
Better Rural Colorado. In that jurisdiction than it would land in like Denver, where I practice. In that jurisdiction, you're used to being out in the elements. You're used to living amongst the ecosystem, which include chipmunks and deer and bears and mountain lions, everything else. And so to take measures to try and, you know, make sure your home is safe and not being overrun by little critters is actually a pretty common thing out in those rural locales in Colorado.
Obviously we learned that Suzanne was having an affair. She was seeing Jeff Lieber secretly for 2 years. They've ruled him out in all of this. He was in another state, and he, I think, was just as shocked to find out what actually went on. But she sent that text, to her husband, Barry, just 3 days before she was killed, saying, I'm done. I don't really care what you're doing anymore. We just need to figure this out civilly. That's going to be looked at as motive from the prosecution. Just a text. We don't have any evidence of Barry threatening her or beating her or anything of that nature. In fact, when they look at the body, there was no evidence of any sort of, you know, broken bones or foul play or anything of that nature. Granted, she was fairly decomposed, so there was a lot of things that you're not going to find. Nothing like that. Just seems the dart is what did its job. How strong do you think the I'm done and the she's having an affair is going to play to a jury? Also, weigh it a little bit too. You know, if a jury member has had a partner that stepped out on them and, you know, did them wrong. Never a reason to kill somebody, but might you find some empathy there from some folks?
Yeah, I mean, a central question for the jury in a case like this is, did the defendant have a reason to off his wife and then enter this text that was very close in time to when the alleged killing happened? That is problematic. It's within the domestic violence context. The lethality within that context is just very high. That's what the statistics show us.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Barry Morphew's daughters have actually been by his side mm-hmm. for most of this case. So the family has sort of sided with him, which is interesting, and which a jury might see as, oh, maybe this was just like a normal relationship problem and not a lethal relationship problem.
That's what I was wondering about as well, because the daughters are still there. But granted, look at a lot of other cases where we know the person's guilty of sin. I mean, Diddy's kids are right there, a little bit different context, but there's been many others where the family stands by them. The Murdaugh trial, I mean, to a certain extent they did. There's been many. Grant, but these are the daughters. These are the ones who actually had a very close relationship with both Suzanne and Barry. They were all pretty tight. And from what we can tell on the surface, had a fairly normal growing up with them and viewed it as a happy, loving family. That's, from the outside, there could have been a lot different going on behind closed doors, but they're still believing Barry could not have possibly done this. Could they testify? Could they be called as witnesses that might affect the jury dynamics and talk about what a wonderful dad is and how they couldn't see this happening?
This is something as a trial practitioner that I use all the time. I think it's underutilized in modern practice of law, and that's character witnesses that can testify to a pertinent trait of the defendant. So here, what could happen is, the prosecution saying he violently killed his wife. Well, he could call his daughters as witnesses to testify as to his trait for peacefulness. And perhaps they would get up there and say, hey, my dad is completely peaceful. I have never seen him hurt my mother. He has always, worked things out as a father and a husband, should arguably or whatever. And I think that could go a long way, because if the own family, who are really the victims in this case, don't believe their dad did it, can a jury really be convinced of?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question there. And they could be very convincing. I've only seen video that they did an interview, I think, a while back, and they seemed pretty convinced that their dad didn't do it. I mean, Tad Daybell's kids also don't think he did it, but it is what it is. Barry filed a $15 million lawsuit for malicious prosecution after the first charges were dropped. Who does that if you're guilty? I mean, obviously, it was all thrown out, without prejudice, meaning it could come back, and it certainly has come back. But who's going to open that door of discovery and everything else that could be brought out in a civil case? That could be far more damning of what could come out in a criminal case. Was he just really calling their bluff and seeing like, see, look, I'm not that guy, because I'd be crazy if I filed this? Or did he know that it was going to get thrown out? What's your thoughts on that move?
If he didn't do it, then he absolutely should bring this for the terror that has been inflicted upon his life wrongfully. If he did do it, what a ballsy move! How audacious to like you said, open the door to really an expanded scope of discovery and evidence. Because on the civil side, you can talk about and get information about a lot of stuff you can't do on the criminal side, and so that's crazy. The one final note is that why we're back here for a second? Second indictment, a second trial? Is it because the government said, oh gosh, we can't pay $15 million, we'll go bankrupt? So instead, we've got to go back on our horse and come after this guy again and win.
I'm thinking of the Making of a Murderer, Dassey mm-hmm. and what's his name in Wisconsin, yeah. Manitowoc. That sort of a thing where, we got to pay. And he won. He won the judgment. And then, we found more evidence to put you away. We've seen that story before. Suzanne's bones were found 45 miles away. Obviously, he went dark on his cell phone for like 8 hours, which, you know, 45 miles takes about 45 minutes. So you got 2 hours to and from, basically. Does that make it harder to link Barry directly, or do you think that that just gives more evidence to support the strangeness of his phone going dark for all that time?
I think it's a complicating factor for the prosecution. You know, there are a lot of moving pieces here, and you know, where the body was found, the fact that the body was had really degraded, those things are problematic. That there was this what appears to be kind of a staging of the bicycle and a helmet at a different location, and it's all very peculiar. But the thing is, the government's it's their job to connect the dots, to bring all of this together, and when you have a bunch of disparate parts of a case, it makes it harder.
It is. And I don't know that this one, I mean, me personally, when I look at this, do I think he likely did it? Yes. But is there, I feel like there's a lot of room for reasonable doubt here. Or that one could interpret as reasonable doubt. It's not quite the there's snow on the ground, how did it get there type moment as the next day. It's like, well, there's a snow cone machine exploded or somebody got a ski lift thing and they're just shooting it in the neighborhood. Possible? Yeah, not likely. I don't know. With this, I mean, you also got the DNA, the unidentified male DNA on her glove box and on her helmet. On paper, it sounds kind of weird, but it wasn't a complete match. So they said there were several people in the CODIS system who it potentially partially matched to. Okay, well, it's a partial match. Every single human being out there, you'd probably have far more matches if this is just a partial match. So I don't have a lot of weight on that one going, well, it was, you know, connected to a predator. It was connected to some men. We don't know who they are, but, you know, I think you go through anybody's car and swab it, you're going to find other DNA from other people in there if anyone has driven with you in any regular, you know, moment. I mean, it could be from anybody. Like, oh, let me give you a quick ride. Somebody from work, whatever. 1,000 reasons why that could be there and not necessarily be tied to the murder. How well, I mean, that's a big thing I think the defense is going to try and play here. How strong of a card is it?
You know, certainly the defense is going to style it as these are alternative suspects whom the government can't identify, whom it doesn't appear that they have investigated thoroughly, and they're just sort of going with blinders on, must have been Barry. That's how defense is going to style it. But yeah, like you said, you know, DNA is everywhere. And, you know, if you've had your car valeted or you've had friends in it or, you know, you've taken it to get serviced or something.
True.
All of those things could be sources of this DNA.
Yeah. I mean, valet, service, all that. You don't know. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, who, I mean, a lot of times I had the car valeted and stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if they did a swab and like somebody that is a valet, maybe on a list somewhere, wouldn't be a shocking thing. Doesn't mean I'm anywhere complicit with anything they're doing, but you know, you live life and you forget about some of those times too, that people would have access there. So again, at the end of the day here, does the state have enough to convict Barry Morphew on their second attempt? What do you think?
I think it's questionable, and I would note that the state actually had the BAM evidence months, if not more than a year ago. They just chose now to bring the charges after this $15 million civil suit was filed against them. And so if they had the goods then, why didn't they bring it then? Now they have the body too, but it's all rather circumstantial. So I think there's a real question mark on this one.
I do too. One of those where it's like, yeah, pretty sure, but do you have the goods? And it is beyond a reasonable doubt, especially in a murder case. So what will happen? That'll be interesting. No date yet announced for any sort of hearings or trials, but probably looking at the very earliest later this year, but most likely next year or the next. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. Thank you for your insight, as always, on this case and the others.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Let's talk about Barry Morphew, the church-going family man, outdoorsy Colorado husband whose wife Suzanne vanished on Mother's Day in 2020. Nothing to see here, right? And whose narrative has unraveled like a deer blind in a hurricane ever since. At first, Barry played the grieving husband role to a T. Press appearances, prayer vigils, choked up denials. But behind the scenes, investigators say his alibi didn't hold. His movements didn't track. And now, 3 years after Suzanne's remains were finally recovered, with a rare tranquilizer in her bones and enough circumstantial weirdness to make even the chipmunks nervous, Barry is facing a second murder indictment. But the case isn't just about the BAM tranquilizer or the seven dumpsters he was putting things in right after she disappeared. It's about what happens when a prosecution bungles a high-profile case so badly the defense doesn't even need to break a sweat. We're talking about withheld evidence, disbarred prosecutors, expert witnesses tossed out like trash. The first attempt to convict Barry was, frankly, a disaster. So what makes the second shot different? That's what we're unpacking today with someone who knows how these things are built and how they fall apart. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis, he's been in the courtroom, he's dealt with these kinds of forensic chess matches, and he's here to give us the legal x-ray of where the prosecution stands now. We're diving into everything from prosecutorial misconduct to consciousness of guilt to whether seven dumpsters and a suddenly GPS-invisible truck are enough to get a jury to bite. And yes, we're even going to talk about Barry's infamous chipmunk excuse. Because this is Colorado, and apparently the rodents are part of the defense strategy. Let's get into it.
Sure. So, and then I practice in Colorado, yeah. So I'm very familiar with this case. In the first round, this was a rather small prosecutor's office, not always used to, you know, monster nationally publicized murder cases. And they made some errors, and they made some serious errors. They didn't turn over some evidence to the defense that they should have turned over. There were other problems with the case, which caused a judge to determine that the prosecution's experts had to be excluded, that they couldn't even use them for the jury. And as we were approaching trial, they had not found the body yet. And so without these experts and without the body, I think the prosecutors folded at that point and dismissed the case. Subsequently, the body was found. Subsequently, there was this analysis that shows this tranquilizer in the victim that they think they can connect to Barry Morphew. So here we are during the second indictment for murder of Barry Morphew concerning his wife.
And there were some very serious things that went on in the first trial. I mean, I believe it was the DA or the prosecutor was disbarred?
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
tell me about that. I mean, explain that. And is that something that could be brought into this trial of like, look what happened the first round?
The prosecutorial misconduct and errors on the government side, including holding on to important evidence and evidence that can be exculpatory, that could show innocence. Prosecution can't do that. That's a cardinal rule. On top of that, there were a series of other errors that caused the elected prosecutor and the jurisdiction to be disbarred. Very uncommon. Now, I think the judge is going to really run a tight ship this second round and probably prohibit the jury from hearing about that disbarment. However, could some of those prosecutorial missteps come into evidence? Could the jury hear about those? Potentially.
And that's, it's not a look you want if you're on the prosecution of any. I mean, granted, I know it's all new prosecutors. It's being tried in a whole different county now. So it's not the same group by any means. But it is something when you're wanting a jury to try and find some sort of reasonable doubt. I mean, if the first one got dropped, why is this one still? I mean, we know why, but it's little things, little nuggets you can throw in there. And hopefully they stick if you're the defense of Barry Morphew. Her remains contained BAM, the rare tranquilizer only Barry is known to have used. It's a big deal. It's a big forensic link. But it is circumstantial. Barry used BAM while deer farming years ago when they were in Indiana, and it really hadn't been, I guess, allegedly using it since. The purchase of it was several years earlier, and they didn't find any on the property when they looked the first time. So we did find a dart cap, a broken dart gun that apparently wasn't working, you know, but I guess all things you would dispose of after you killed someone or make your gun look like it's not operable. What do you think about that? The fact that there wasn't the chemical in the house to go and say, look, this is you. It's just we got receipts for you buying it a long time ago in a different state.
You know, I think the government is going to be fine neutralizing that issue because that they have a lot of other evidence. What they say is buried, covering this up, doing concealing measures to make sure he doesn't get caught. He's going around to all these different dumpsters and dumping stuff. And you know, there's no real reason why he would need to go to four different dumpsters to do that. And so I think the government's going to say, hey, even though it wasn't on his property at the time, that's because he covered this up because he knew we were coming for him.
Yeah, I mean, there's all of that. A lot of consciousness there that looks of guilt and the seven dumpsters going and dumping stuff. And yeah, on the surface, I can't think of any reason one would be going to seven different dumpsters to be dumping different things, unless they're all full, which is a stupid excuse. But he's saying, I go out here, I'm a contractor, I got a lot of junk in my truck, I don't like to go pay the dump fee, so I just kind of dump it around at different places. I don't know. I mean, I think people may look at that and go, well, I'm not a contractor, so maybe they do move it around at different, I don't, it seems unlikely. It seems like a contractor wouldn't be going to seven different dumpsters, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, quite honestly.
I think there's some plausibility to that defense, and I don't know personally.
Yeah.
But there are complicating observations as well. So some of Barry Morphew's workers claim that that day, when the government thinks he was sort of covering all of this up, there was the strong smell of bleach around him that wouldn't have been necessary at the particular job site. There were just some other curious circumstances for Barry Morphew in terms of how he was moving around the state and that kind of thing that I think make things more suspicious. But then again, maybe it was just a contractor, you know, trying his best to dump out stuff where he could dump it out. Could be.
Could it be just a case of the worst coincidences ever? I don't know about that. Barry's phone also went into airplane mode minutes after Suzanne's last text to her lover. Again, not the best of timing here. A blackout like that, I mean, does that suggest consciousness of guilt in a legal context? And also, with his phone, his vehicle GPS also went dark. I don't even know how you do that, but apparently there's something you can unplug somewhere where your vehicle's going to stop tracking you, and then it turns back on suspiciously several hours later, 8 hours later. Oh, weird.
You know, yeah, I think people are sort of getting wise to the fact that our phones all have GPS, and if a person didn't want to be tracked, they would have to somehow deactivate that, and it looks like that could be what happened. Alternatively, you know, he might say, hey, my phone went dead at that time, and there was nothing I could do about it, and so it wasn't covering something up. And so all of these peculiar circumstances are going to be up to the juror's interpretation, and they're going to look at it as a whole when combined with all of, you know, the bleach smell and the multiple dumpsters and this BAM. You know, is that going to be enough to get the prosecution over the hump? That's the question.
How many experienced chipmunk hunters do you think are going to be on the jury? Serious question.
You know,
how many?
In that part of Colorado, more than you'd expect, but still, you know, there are a lot of interesting wrinkles to this sort of rurally set case that are going to be specific to that locale. And so these jurors are going to know more about squirrel hunting than certainly I am.
Y'all got a chipmunk epidemic in Colorado. And I've been there. I mean, there's like one mountain town where I've gone to, and it was an old mining town. It's like haunted or something, and there's not much up there. But it's like, the chipmunks, there's hundreds of them, and they hang out on like wood and pallets. You can walk over, they'll climb on you. It's the craziest. I've like video of the kids when they were younger at this, like, you got chipmunks, you got prairie dogs, you got the rodents going on. And they're surprisingly like fairy rodents. They're very friendly. I do like the rodents in Colorado. I don't know if the chipmunks.
Yeah, they're Those are.
I don't know if a chipmunk's a rodent, but they seem friendly. But
there are places where the chipmunks are really the ones in charge. I think they have seats on city council by now.
Yeah.
But there are some issues once you get closer to the mountains with those little critters.
It makes you wonder. So I could see that. I could see. I know the chipmunk analogy sounds ridiculous to a lot of people. I have to admit, in Wisconsin, I have hunted a few chipmunks in my time. I'm not proud of it. I was a smaller child, and my dad said, here's the BB gun. Go take care of the chipmunks. And you know, when you're taking out chipmunks, you do run around your yard a lot. I will attest that that is a real thing if you are hunting a chipmunk with a BB gun. I think maybe a poison dart might be a bridge too far for a chipmunk. But, he told investigators that his erratic phone movements were from chasing chipmunks. How do you think that'll land out there in Colorado?
Better Rural Colorado. In that jurisdiction than it would land in like Denver, where I practice. In that jurisdiction, you're used to being out in the elements. You're used to living amongst the ecosystem, which includes chipmunks and deer and bears and mountain lions, everything else. And so to take measures to try and, make sure your home is safe and not being overrun by little critters is actually a pretty common thing out in those rural locales in Colorado.
So here's where we land. You've got a man who says he was just another Colorado contractor chasing chipmunks and dodging dump fees. You got a woman whose body turned up 3 years later with BAM, an animal tranquilizer tied to Barry's past, lingering in her remains. And you've got a prosecution trying to convince a jury that the dots connect to one conclusion: murder. But what makes the case so fascinating and infuriating is how many opportunities were missed the first time around. The original prosecution wasn't just flawed, it was broken. Evidence was withheld, experts were disqualified, and the DA disbarred. That's not a bad day in court, that's a courtroom collapse and a career collapse. So now we're back. New team, new county, new indictment. But the same big question: is the evidence strong enough this time to stick? Is the story they're telling airtight or just cleverly rearranged circumstantial pieces? Eric Faddis gave us something rare, real insight into how a case like this plays to a jury. The legal weight of circumstantial evidence, the danger of relying too heavily on forensic novelties like tranquilizer residue, and the psychological tightrope a prosecutor walks when they're already blown the case once, or another prosecutor has. But here's what still lingers. Why BAM? Why the conveniently timed phone and GPS blackouts? Why 7 dumpsters? Why the smell of bleach? There's a pattern of concealment here that is hard to ignore. And while that might not be enough to convince on its own, it sure makes you wonder, if Barry Morphew is truly innocent, why does his behavior scream the opposite? In the end, the law demands proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But in the court of public opinion, you don't need a microscope. You just need a gut. And Barry's story, I think to a lot of us, it kind of stinks.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Suzanne Morphew. She vanished on Mother's Day of 2020. And from day one, her husband, Barry, well, his story kind of reeked of performance art. A missing bike, no signs of struggle, and a guy more concerned with trash runs than finding his wife. Fast forward to 2023, Suzanne's remains are found buried in the mountains with traces of a rare animal tranquilizer, BAM, in her bones. The substance only Barry had access to, and its name is BAM. I'm not just emeralding it and saying BAM at random now. Add the dart cap to his laundry, a little weird, deleted texts, a truck and phone that conveniently went dark, and a wife who just told him she was done, and suddenly Barry's chipmunk shooting alibi doesn't quite hold up. Prosecutors say it's a textbook case of control, planning, and murder. Barry says it's just all bunch of coincidences. Now, 2025 re-indictment on the table. The question is, will the forensic trail finally stick, or will Barry slide out again on technicalities and doubt? Joining me to discuss, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, and her new book is out, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. And on audiobook, too. That's how I listened in the car on a road trip recently. It was a good read. Suzanne's final text to Barry, Siobhan, it said, I'm done. Let's figure this out civilly. It also said, I don't care what you do or what you're up to. Let's figure this out civilly. Clearly was laying it out there of, I'm done.
Clear message.
Yeah. Psychologically, how dangerous is it when a partner with controlling tendencies is confronted with that kind of finality?
It is the most dangerous time for a woman to be murdered. And we have many decades of data on that. Most of the, you know, the majority of women who are killed are murdered by a partner or a former partner. It most often happens when they're trying to leave the relationship. And clearly she gave a nice clear message, and it was just a few days later and she disappeared. So another chilling story where she had communicated with her sister that he was physically and emotionally abusive. She had communicated with a friend that she didn't feel safe alone with him. So this is one we wish there would have been a way to intervene earlier. We like to think we can prevent these things, but it's another insidious aspect of, you know, these domestic violence kind of relationships, these controlling narcissistic relationships. And it's, you know, it's horrendous.
It's one of those things where a lot of people, and I don't know what was going on through Suzanne's mind, but I think a lot of us, or pretty much all of us for the most part, like to think, well, it can't get that bad. It can't happen to me. I can't be a Dateline episode. That's a little much. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can be. And and you can be fairly easily. It doesn't take a lot to push someone with these sort of tendencies over a further edge to where this sort of thing took place. She sent the message on May 6, 2020. 3 days later, she vanished. Barry allegedly deleted that message, but saved the screenshot, which I find to be a little weird. What, or maybe it's not, what do you make of that? Deleting the message, keeping the screenshot of the end of your marriage, and just a very stark, clear message of that.
That's a hard one to speculate about. The only thing that comes into my mind was this was carried symbolic meaning for him about why he was justified in taking the action that he took. It's like, here's a reminder to myself about why I needed to do this.
Do you think this is something where he's sitting there for those 3 days after she got that message sent to him, planning how he was going to do this? Was this more of a heat of the moment type thing? She shows back up to get some stuff, and then he's chasing her around the house allegedly with the dart gun. I mean, how premeditated do you think this sort of thing was, considering the evidence and stuff that he put up of like, well, here's why it couldn't be me? I mean, he pretty much walks investigators like right up to all the places he went and why he was there with really stupid excuses.
My guess is it was premeditated, and he may have been fantasizing about how he would get rid of her for a long time. It was a very, we can say, innovative method that once they found the body was pretty easily traced back to him as the only person in the vicinity that had that kind of poison. So, probably pre-planned, but not well-planned, we can say.
Let's just talk about the method itself. BAM. It's a rare animal tranquilizer found in Suzanne's bones. So he used this sedative instead of brute force or, you know, a different type of weapon, a gun, you know, that would be messy if you're firing bullets off. He used allegedly a dart, a tranquilizer, to basically get her and take her down. No mess. Just a body that now has been poisoned and is likely going to die. What do you take? What's your take on that? Just the method itself, avoiding the mess, avoiding all of that, and avoiding having to exert the physical, you know, angst that a lot of abusers want to do on their subject. This was just a boom, she's down. There was no signs of struggle or broken bones or anything like that on her body when they found her.
Yeah, that speaks of pre-planning, right? And and what he thought he could control and get away with. And he was a hunter, and he took down animals with this substance all the time. So clearly this was something that was in his wheelhouse. He felt very confident and comfortable with it, and I guess was good at hitting moving targets at the same time. So it's, yeah, another weird, weird thing that none of us would normally think about something like this, but for this guy, it makes sense.
It's like there was a moment of evil clarity of, well, I did, if I do this, there won't be the big mess, but everything else didn't seem to be thought out too well. Let me ask you about this. I mean, this is going to be going towards, if this goes to trial, if the jury gets it, there's going to be argument about the BAM itself, because yes, Barry had past access to BAM from his deer farming days, and I say that loosely, in Indiana. He was the only private person in the region known to have it. Now, we don't know for sure, because they didn't find any on his person or in his home at the place where this murder did take place, and the purchase of the BAM would have actually been a couple years earlier, according to records. But, you know, he's an avid hunter. He's an avid guy that goes and rips antlers off of deer and leaves them to die, or lets them come back alive and rip them off again. He's a nice type of guy, you know? He's a lover, not a fighter. And he just that whole mindset of someone like that, having it at the time of the murder versus just ordering it far early on. The fact that we didn't have it in the residence here this time, but they found the dart cap or a dart cap. Is that going to leave some room for question of reasonable doubt if they didn't find the actual substance there? Again, not a crazy,
Yeah, I guess if I could put myself in the position of being his defense attorney, that would be the one big thing to go for, is that you just don't have proof. But who knows? I don't think they know what was in all those trash bags he was throwing away either, right? That would be lovely to have access to that.
Yeah.
What was he getting rid of?
Yeah, because that doesn't show anything weird when he's going to seven different trash dumpsters around the area, dumping something unique at each location, and his excuse is, I just like to do that because I don't like to pay the landfill fees. Seven dumpsters? Really?
Seven dumpsters.
Were they all full and you just had to put a little, you only fit a little bit in each one? You know, that's, it's a little odd. It looks a little suspicious.
It's also, you know, if we could give all these murderers a tip, it's like, realize there are cameras everywhere now. It's like they don't seem to put that together. And how many of these things are you know, the dots are connected because of film footage that we get. Yeah.
It makes you wonder. I mean, I don't know. Are people looking at the gas station cameras that are hanging outside some of these places and they look kind of, you know, dusty, little cobwebby? Ah, that probably doesn't work. And going with that, I don't know. I mean, they got to be telling themselves something, or they're just that ignorant and they don't think that part through. I don't know why one wouldn't at this day and age, but
that would be a good question to ask them. Did you ever stop and ponder that you were being filmed when you did all this? Yeah,
it's a good question to ask someone like that. If I'm ever, and I don't think I have, but if I ever do interview someone, a criminal who has gotten or attempted to get away with something caught on camera, that's a very just basic. But an obvious one that I don't think they get asked very often.
No. If you watch BritBox, all the British detective shows, I like that channel, and they're all caught with CCTV footage.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in England, they would never catch a criminal if they didn't have CCTV everywhere.
Yeah.
So maybe in England, they're more aware of it.
Yeah. Suzanne reportedly said she didn't feel safe being alone with Barry. That's a big thing. She's telling it to friends. She's telling it to people, but she did go back there to get her stuff. If someone is feeling that way in a relationship, that they still have all their stuff at the house. Maybe don't go there alone. And I'm not trying to victim shame or anything here. I'm just trying to say people need to think a little bit more. This is kind of what I was at to earlier of, it can't happen to me. It can't.
Yeah.
It can't. Do people need to be more aware of how real these sort of things are and how common they actually do take place?
I think so. I think that's one of the focuses of my work is trying to raise awareness of you know, the potential for violent outcomes when women are trying to get out of relationships. And I would, anybody who doesn't feel safe around their partner, particularly if there are ongoing marital problems or they're trying to leave the relationship, I would encourage them to contact a domestic violence hotline. There's a national, you know, if you just put in Google National Domestic Violence Hotline, you can text them. It's a 24/7 service. A lot of communities have local domestic violence counseling services just to have some support and get some tips on how to stay safe. That's one of the big things their counselors do.
And another interesting point of this whole case is that his daughters, who were close to both parents, it wasn't like the marriage obviously was strained, but the relationship from what we know, the daughters, you know, they love both their parents very much. They were close with both. And they still stood by dad after he was almost going to trial a couple of years ago. I don't think mention that portion of this. This is the second time charges have been brought against him. They were dropped earlier on. Because there was misconduct, they believe, on the part of the prosecution, getting late for deadlines. The prosecution, the actually original prosecutors, were disbarred. That's a big thing there. But they still stayed with dad, and that's the point. There had to have been red flags. There had to have been some sort of signs in that home of coercive control or something, you know, growing up, that maybe things weren't the greatest with mom and dad. What's your take on this, that they still stand by him? Was just everything maybe too normalized that they just couldn't conceive of this happening? Or did Barry and Suzanne really hide it that well from the kids, that they really would think this is a complete impossibility?
They probably did hide it pretty effectively from the kids, but also kids that grow up in incredibly dysfunctional homes don't know that it's abnormal.
Yeah.
And they tend to not see things. And he may, in very many ways, have been an adequate father for them and have a bond with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of like restricted his more pathological controlling behavior to his wife. And we do know that she suspected him of having affairs. She was having an affair, but all of this was very secret. Mm-hmm. And so the kids are probably at that difficult phase that we often talk about of just not being able to see that their father could be a murderer. It's just not in their reality at this point. So that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I can understand that. Suzanne had a secret affair for almost 2 years from a trauma and self-worth perspective. Now, what drives someone to emotionally check out of their marriage before just physically leaving it? Like, why stay? And it's a million-dollar question to everybody who does this. It's why not just leave? Why, you know, why go down that road? What do you think might have been going on in Suzanne's mind that kept her married to him, but still trying to get that fulfillment elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. It's definitely best before you have the affair to just end the relationship and get out of it. I think that's a cleaner break, a better way to do it. But so many people don't do it that way. And they desperately are looking for solace. They're looking for comfort. They're looking for support. And they often have affairs. It's sort of like a transitional object for them. And my guess also is that she was frightened to leave him and may have had a lot of anxiety about making the final break. And sometimes people have a long phase of having to work up to doing it. Mm-hmm. And in her case, I'm sure she was a homemaker. She had concerns about how she was going to get through it financially. And sometimes people have to go through a planning phase for, okay, what am I going to do? What is it going to look like? Am I going to end up with this other man that I'm seeing? As I understand, he was married and had 5 or 6 kids himself, mm-hmm. although they were talking about being together. So it really is fairly common for people to exit marriages by having affairs and taking their time in doing it.
Very allegedly presented their marriage as being very happy. Obviously, while Suzanne was documenting feelings of being controlled. How common is it for abusers to present that false public image and also to believe their false public image, to really mm-hmm. think things are hunky-dory here, mm-hmm. the way I'm doing things, and not having any clue that your partner is that level of unhappy?
100%. You nailed it. And these folks are, of course, if you're a murderer, you're going to be cluster B. So you've got the narcissism there, always wanting to give a good impression publicly. And that doesn't surprise me. And in his mind, he was a great guy. And if there was any unhappiness, loneliness, dissatisfaction on her part, it was not on his radar at all. And he really didn't care.
Yeah. And there were a lot of signs in here that I guess when normalized, one wouldn't see until sometimes mm-hmm. you're out of that bubble. And maybe you would have seen it earlier. Maybe you would have seen it 10 years earlier and gone, huh? But once you're so far deep in, you're not realizing it. Barry allegedly was checking her spending, questioning her constantly, and policing her communications as well. So a lot of lack of trust. Mm-hmm. Is it lack of trust or need for control when someone is doing something like that? Because even if the person's not going out of control with spending, they're not doing anything crazy, there's no reason you need to police their communications. Mm-hmm. And you should not be in a relationship with anybody that you have to be doing those sort of things with.
No.
But the fact that, you know, someone is doing that, is that a control or is that a I don't trust you type thing, or maybe a little bit of both in their mind?
Probably both, yeah, because a person like this often has some paranoid tendencies. They can misperceive benign things as someone is up to something or doing something to them, and that's just sort of this subtle style of thinking that they have. But the need to control is overwhelming, and that can confuse women for a long time, that they don't, you know, when they're used to it, they don't see how bizarre it is.
I would say for both parties, honestly, not in this case, but for both men and women, because both sides can very much do that to one another. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times it starts with an argument of, well, it's because I care about you. Well, it's because I love you, because I just want to make sure you're okay, or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, someone is throwing out there. And maybe it starts innocently. Maybe it starts out of insecurity and they just want to know whatever the hell they want to know. Mm-hmm. But then it seems like once you give an inch with someone like that and go, okay, well, you can, we'll do life 360, or we'll do the phone monitoring, you turn my location on, that so many people mm-hmm. do today. Mm-hmm. And then it's, well, I want to know this too. And I want to know that too. Mm-hmm. That can mm-hmm. be very insidious. And a lot of people mm-hmm. don't tend to see that until it is too late. Where is the mm-hmm. line on that? Like, where is the line where this is healthy, we just care about each other, you know, and we just, you know, want to know where each other is if we needed it, not like, I'm sitting here, where are you at? That doesn't look like the grocery store, you know, why are you in a neighborhood or some BS like that, versus a healthy way of keeping tabs on each other out of care and love versus control and fear.
That's a really good question, and probably a bit different with every couple. The red flag that I always notice is the compulsive checking of the other person's phone for texts. And now sometimes that can make sense because they have radar and there are a lot of things that feel like there's some duplicity going on here. And so they do get paranoid, but it's kind of grounded in reality. So mm-hmm. they start, you know, sneaking, looking at the phone. And very often they find things. But as I tell people, if you're in a relationship where you have to try, you know, going through each other's email, checking phones. What are the other ones that they do? Recording as what's going on
in this marriage's yeah.
secret pen recording. When you have to secretly record each other, this is, you know, get to a marriage therapist quick or determine, do I really need to be in a relationship where this kind of stuff is going on?
Now, yeah.
My husband tracks my phone when I'm out of the house because I get lost. And we do live in a big city where if you go into certain parts of town, there can be carjackings and crime. And he says it just, and I know he's doing it. I support that.
Yeah.
The problem was the time I took an Uber to the far end of town and I accidentally left my phone in the Uber.
Yeah.
And so Mike was seeing my phone track all over the city in this wild pattern, and he was certain I had been kidnapped.
Sure. And,
so eventually we worked that out. But don't leave your phone in the Uber. But yeah, there are times when I think it makes perfect sense, but when it's coming from a place of pathological control where people really don't trust each other, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the foundation of a good marriage is trust. You know, you want this person to be your safe person, not the person you have to walk on eggshells with or worry about.
And I would say that power, if it's been normalized of like, okay, we're watching each other, can also be used as a negative against the people as well. Like if it's okay, we're doing this because I care. And you're like, okay, you know, whatever, you go along with it for a long time. And then they go out to go do something and then they just disappear off of it. Then you can't track them when they're going out, but they want to track you when you're going out.
Very much.
Or let's just say they get really angry and then decide to disappear in Las Vegas and turn their tracking off. I've had that happen before.
Wow.
And they ended up on the highway and in a psych ward. Suzanne's last known location was out there in the yard. The GPS on Barry's phone shows him all over the place. He says he was hunting chipmunks. In the backyard, because there's a big chipmunk problem out there, I guess, and not his wife. Is that kind of a desperate? You think that was a question that surprised Barry when it came up? Like, why does your GPS show like you're all over the place?
Oh, I think he was very surprised at that one, because that is the lamest story. Where are all the little chipmunk bodies, right? How many chipmunks did you take out? Were they in the trash bag that that was all these bodies of chipmunks that he was dumping at the Holiday Inn trash? I mean, you know, weird. Yeah, I think that was a pretty lame one, Barry.
Dumping chipmunk bodies at the Holiday Inn trash. That's like the weirdest sentence I've heard.
I can do weird.
I like that. Chipmunk bodies at the Holiday Inn trash. Wouldn't that be
a weird title? Title for a book.
It is. You're emptying out your cooler. Ah, this ham's gone bad. What's in it? Oh my God, it's a box of chipmunks. What's going on here? Although in Salida, Colorado, anything is possible. It really, truly is. Anyway, I think that'll wrap that up for our discussion here of what the hell's going on in this case. There's a lot to come as the progression of this goes, hearings and such, all on the way to determine if Barry Morphew is going to be going to trial in the coming, I'm going to say years at this point. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist, author of Nightbird. Go check it out wherever you get books. We'll talk again real soon.
Craving non-stop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, Summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish, but breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale is almost here. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair, plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping site-wide. Shop the sale at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish, but breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale is almost here. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair, plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping site-wide. Shop the sale at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.